Hi, I'm David Lazarus, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of April 26, 2013. Remember the sequester, all that backing and forthing over the federal budget that had people in Washington foaming at the mouth and had the rest of us, many of us, falling asleep? This week, mean old Mr. Sequester was back in the news as some federal employees were forced to take a few days per month of unpaid leave. Furloughs, they're called. But as the week went on, it was kind of hard figuring out who was off the clock and who wasn't, not to mention how things were affecting ordinary working stiffs. But one thing was clear. The nation's airports were hit hard by the furloughs of air traffic controllers, so much so that members of Congress managed to rouse themselves to do something about it. I'm joined by Nancy Marshall-Genzer of our Washington, D.C. Bureau to round up the week's news. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, David.
All right, so where are we at now?
As you know, the news was full of this all week. There were flight delays across the country, Chicago, New York, where you are, Los Angeles, Atlanta. On one day alone, the FAA said there had been at least 863 flights delayed. So if you multiply that by about a week, we're talking thousands of flight delays. This kept Congress busy right up to the weekend trying to resolve this. So that the furloughs would not affect air traffic controllers. And a number of federal agencies at this point have received some kind of a reprieve, right? So we've got the air traffic controllers. We got a hold of a memo from Attorney General Eric Holder at the Justice Department. Turns out those workers aren't going to be furloughed either. So we're talking about thousands of FBI, ATF agents who were very busy with the Boston bombings, by the way. They will not be furloughed. Also, meat inspectors. The Agriculture Department was given some flexibility with its funding, so meat inspectors are not going to be furloughed.
So wait a minute. It sounds like the whole furlough thing not as severe as we thought, or is it?
Well, it kind of depends who you are, David. For example, if you're pretty crucial, like you're a meat inspector or you're an air traffic controller, well, you're not being furloughed. But workers at the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, have started their furloughs. Workers at the Labor Department have started their furloughs. The Defense Department is still a big question mark. Of course, if you're in uniform, you are not going to be furloughed. But some civilian Defense Department employees were supposed to be furloughed. And first, the Defense Department whittled down the number of furlough days. And then Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel told Congress he was hoping there wouldn't be any furloughs at all. It's still a question mark. We emailed the DOD. They are still planning for furloughs. They could occur in mid-June, which means that workers would be notified in May because they need 30 days notice of any furlough.
So it sounds like I'll be able to fly to a national park, but when I get there, there's going to be nobody there to open the gate.
Maybe. The situation at national parks varies. But I'm going to just look at one park, which I think is sort of representative of what's happening across the country. Acadia National Park in Maine. You been there, David?
No, but I want to.
Oh, you got to go. It's beautiful. But here's the situation there, which I say is, as I say, is representative of other parks. So the park itself is open, but there's something called the Park Loop Road that goes to all the attractions. It's not going to open for another month. It's opening May 25th. So, you know, consumers are going to still be feeling the effects of the sequester. Also, the DOD has canceled air shows. The Blue Angels, the Thunderbirds are not going to be flying. Fleet Week up in New York City was canceled. That's where they bring up all the big ships, and it's kind of a recruiting event for the Navy, but it's also fun for tourists to see these huge ships. That's been canceled. So people are going to see the effects, but they're not going to be waiting in long lines at the airport.
And how many members of Congress and senators are being furloughed?
Zero.
There's a
but
surprise.
But their staffs will be affected. And there is some members of Congress have agreed to not accept part of their salaries in solidarity with their workers who are going to be facing furloughs.
Profiles in Courage. That's Nancy Marshall-Genzer from our Washington, D.C. Bureau. Nancy, thank you very much.
You're welcome, David.
We'll be keeping an eye on the furlough situation as it develops and watching how it affects all our lives and your life in particular. Got a furlough fiasco story to share? Contact us via Facebook, Twitter, or at MarketplaceMoney.org. Remember how we told you last week we'd be including more of you on the show? Well, here you are. We got all sorts of support from listeners who wrote in via Facebook and Twitter and even old-fashioned email. Ron Spear sent us a note asking for help with budgeting for sequester-related furloughs. He's a federal employee with the Department of Defense who lives in Richmond Hill, Georgia. Do I have that right, Ron?
Yes, sir.
And also joining us is Kevin Livingston. He's a California state employee who was hired during a spate of recent government furloughs and learned some valuable lessons going through that. Hiya, Kevin.
Hi.
All right, let's start with you, Kevin. Just how did being furloughed from your public sector job affect your day-to-day life?
You know, I'm a conservationist, so I do more with less anyway. So it's kind of just, it was normal. It wasn't a big deal. And I was a young professional, and it was more pay than what I was used to begin with. But then when it hit and I understood, it got harder, and ended up going into debt every year. And then how I ended up paying off that debt every year was with my tax return.
Well, how much debt did you go into?
With my last tax returns, we just paid off. We had $4,000 to $5,000 in debt.
And that's because?
You know, I went and rented an apartment thinking the salary was three times the rent. Next thing I knew, it was closer to two times the rent. So it made it harder. For sure.
All right. So, Ron, let me turn to you. You're facing now what Kevin has gone through. How much anxiety does something like that cause?
It builds slowly, and then it hits you very quickly. Earlier in the year, I knew it was potentially coming, but I think like a lot of us and the government employees didn't really think it would hit and didn't realize the scope of it. And then once the news started getting a little louder there in February, realized that I really need to get ready for this.
Is there talk among DOD employees as to how much your income could go down if the sequester axe falls?
Well, I haven't received any official notification, so I can only go off what's in the news. And I guess what everybody's reporting is could be one day a week, which basically works out to be about a 20% reduction of income.
That's a pretty big hit. Are you anticipating how you might change things around to accommodate that?
Yes. I've done a few things already to get ready. Been a longtime listener, so I've been doing almost everything that I'm hopefully supposed to be doing financially. The only thing I was kind of not doing real well was my emergency fund or my FU fund. So back in January, I reduced my contributions to my 401k that the government has called the Thrift Savings Plan from 15% down to 5%, where I get my 5% matching. I've been doing really good at saving in that, but I've been putting that extra money into my emergency fund so that I've got a little bit more cash on hand.
Now, as a long-term listener of the show, Ron, you know that fiddling with your retirement planning, not always the best idea.
Well, I understand, but the way I look at it, I'm still putting about 10% of my income into the retirement fund, but I'm also not dipping into what I already, my substantial savings that I have in there. And my plan was only to sock away some money here for 6 to 9 months until the situation settles out and becomes clear, and then I'll readjust and go back to my normal savings.
All right. First of all, let me give you total milk and cookies for being on top of it. That's great. Now let's take a closer look at some of your planning because, yeah, shrewdly, you're not going into your 401k and taking money out. Okay, A-plus for that. You've cut back your contribution with an expectation that you'll pick it up again. I like that, but I wonder whether there aren't ways to economize elsewhere that would allow you to maintain your giving into your 401k. For example, do you have a big cable bill?
Yes, I probably do.
See, that's always a place that I start looking when people talk to me about this kind of thing, is you think about all those extra premium channels, HBO, Showtime, Stars, all the rest. These add some serious bucks on an annual basis. Now, I know, you know, Game of Thrones is on. You don't want to walk away from HBO necessarily. At the same time, what you're doing is essentially keeping instant gratification ahead of long-term security. And I'm here to tell you that long-term security is a higher priority than instant gratification. And that's why looking at things like your cable package, a great place to start. When you look around at your lifestyle, there are other elements that you might think about, for instance, restaurant meals, clothing, other things that might be more luxuries and necessities?
Yeah, and we've done some of that. We did decide this year not to take a vacation. We've already scaled back on eating out, and when we do go out, we don't order beverages. Here in the South, you always got to get tea with your dinner, and that's can be $2 or $3 depending on where you're at. So we're scaling back a little bit there, and really I just want to wait and see how my first paychecks look after the furloughs hit, and then I'll make further cuts in some of those other things, like with my kids' after-school activities.
That tea thing, is that like a local law?
Yes, sir.
I thought so. My Southern-born producer is nodding her head saying, yeah, come on. Kevin, let me turn back to you. All right, so here we all are. We're talking about the things that Ron should be thinking about. What kind of advice can you offer?
You know, I did those things. I definitely cut the cable. I looked into, like, streaming internet or things like that. But yeah, it hits hard. I mean, the last 3 years is like being in a coma almost, you know. Just it was really financially strapped down. But the good news was, I'm not at work. I'm at home with the family, you know. Finding ways to not spend money and having a good time with the family. And, you know, from my perspective, I took the job with the government. Government work to me pays not too good to begin with. You know, and I'm called a civil servant, and I serve the people. And so I just go back to, you know, I got to serve the people. If this is what they want and this is what they get, you got to love what you're doing and really care about what you're doing and just believe in the future. And that kind of got me through. Just being glad, you know, a lot of people ended up not having a job or anything like that. And things happen. Things work out. And in the meantime, I had to make sure I was still loving what I did.
And very quickly, Kevin, at the back end of these furloughs, were you able to pick up again on your spending from before?
Yeah, the good news about all this is using the credit and then paying it off, my credit score has gone way up. And I've gotten some great, sweet credit card offers, and I've been able to save lately. And just took the family to Disneyland, and it was kind of like a breath of fresh air to get out of it in a way. So things are looking up for us.
All right, Ron, it's good news for you.
Yes, sir. I think I'm on the right track. I'll look at trying to pick back up on my 401k contributions and find some money elsewhere.
Well, that's great. I hope you don't get furloughed, but if you do, and if anyone else listening does, now you got some advice to help you through it. Kevin Livingston is a California State employee. Ron Spear works for the Department of Defense. Thank you very much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In my day job at the Los Angeles Times, I'm the paper's consumer guy, the one you turn to when you've got some business headache to remedy, and I see my share of scams. So do you, it turns out. At least that's the impression we got when we sent our reporters onto the streets of New York and L.A. to chat with people who've gotten a bitter taste of scam soup.
Once there were just people selling on the street. You know how they try to sell you like these packages to hair salons or something? They're usually by colleges and by schools. They try to get a lot of students to buy them. So I think I ended up buying a package for like $60 and called the place and it didn't exist.
It was a dermatologist, yes, at the doctor's. I went for a prescription, and I was charged $500 for a doctor visit where nothing was done, so I was conned.
I think I was at the tennis center in Queens, and the guy was selling tickets, and so he sold us a ticket. I think we paid like $70 or $80 for it, and then when we tried to go through, these tickets were user-ready. But I think we spent $140, $150 for tickets. And like, and my husband went to look for the guy. And, of course, he was gone. He wasn't there. He ran away as soon as he sold us the tickets. So we felt like fools to, you know, to fall in for that.
But wait, there's more. A few weeks ago, we asked you to write in and tell us stories about scams you've encountered. And you flooded our inbox with some pretty horrific experiences. John Gentile of Miami emailed us with a particularly striking story. He lost $150,000 to a Ponzi scheme run by a lifelong friend, thanks, dude, and got several members of his family caught up in the racket as well. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So how are things in Miami?
Well, it's a beautiful day here. It's about 80 degrees, very nice, sunny.
Good day for scams?
Yeah, it's always a good day for scams down here.
Well, tell me your story.
I guess about 15 years ago, I began to invest with a good friend of mine, someone I knew for 38 years, and he approached me about doing first mortgages on properties. And I asked him to explain it. He said to me, well, these are people that they don't have enough credit to go to the bank, but their property is secured by the mortgage that we're going to get is going to be a first mortgage secured by the value of the property. And I said, yeah, sounds good. So I gave him some money and did well. And a few years later, I gave him some more money. And then my family asked me about it, and I explained it to them. And I said, it's been good to me. And a lot of us gave him money. My family did, to the tune of about $1.8 million.
A lot of money.
A lot of money over the span of probably from 99 to, I would say, 2009, probably about 10 years.
And what kind of return did you get on an annual basis?
We received interest payments every month of between 10 to 12%.
So that's a great return. You can't argue with that.
No. I thought it was a fine return. Again, he was somebody I felt he could have been part of my family. That's how much I trusted him.
And then?
Well, the check started to bounce. And then more checks started to bounce until finally it became obvious that there was a problem. So I met with him and I said, look, Warren, you got to do something. Cut the interest rate. Do something. Yeah, I'm going to fix it up. I'm going to cut the interest rate. My sister, who had a lot of money invested along with me and my mother-in-law, my sister-in-law, we went to an attorney. They said, we don't handle this, but we got to tell you, this looks like a Ponzi scheme. A Ponzi scheme from my good friend of 30 years? Can't be. No way. We called him in, and I'll never forget, he sat in my office with myself, my brother-in-law, and another investor, and he said, things were done wrong, and I know I could go to jail, and I'm prepared to do so if I have to. So we knew we were in deep trouble. We contacted an attorney. We instituted a civil suit, which didn't amount to much. We then went to the FBI, and they arrested him for mail fraud and a Ponzi scheme. He was tried, convicted, and in July of 2011, he was sentenced to 17 and a half years in federal prison.
And for anyone who doesn't quite know, a Ponzi scheme is a racket whereby you're constantly bringing in new victims to bring in more money, and the money gradually makes its way to others. And those who get in early tend to get some money. Those who get in late tend to not get so much money. This is how Bernie Madoff got into so much trouble. Do you have any idea, John, how many people were victimized here?
You know, somewhere in the realm of around 45 to 50 people. There again, my family was maybe six or seven, but there are other people in other groups that were involved.
Were there actually properties out there that were being invested in?
Well, that's what he says. The problem was, and this is certainly a mistake I made, and when I'm asked about it, you know, we never received anything. We never received any mortgage documents. Of course, you could say to me, John, how stupid you were. And I would say, David, you're right. I mean, I realize that now is it's easy to look back on someone that you've known for many years. But there were properties that he was investing in. They were homes. They were apartment buildings. Again, they were first mortgages, but we never received anything. Towards the end, when things got bad, he gave us a promissory note, but that was not worth much more than the paper it was written on because there wasn't anything at that point. He lost everything. Apparently, everything went into foreclosure. He lost his own personal property, his other properties, businesses that he had. By the time he went away, there wasn't really much, according to the FBI, of value at all.
How much did you and your family lose?
Almost $1.8 million.
So the whole thing?
Yes.
And there were no properties to fall back on, to foreclose upon, to,
no,
to walk away with?
There was nothing. The FBI went after that. There were businesses. And they say this is typical. They say that by the time the scheme unravels, there's not a lot there.
When he actually had his come-to-Jesus moment in your office and admitted something was amiss, did you see remorse in his eyes? Was he contrite?
Did I see remorse? He never said he was sorry. Someone asked me that the other day. He never said, I'm very sorry. He said, things were done wrong. People let me down. I know I couldn't go to jail. He never said, I have to tell you, John, I'm so sorry for you and your family. No. You know, he's a sociopath. And sociopaths, I read about this a lot. They don't think they did anything wrong. They're liars. They really think that they helped you and you didn't get it. The only time he ever apologized was a generic apology in court in front of the judge. That's not worth a hill of beans to me. I'm sure his attorney said, you better apologize, you know? That's it.
So, John, if I told you that I've got a great scheme for making some money for you and your family, what would you tell me?
Boy, I would go so far the other way, you couldn't even find me, okay?
John, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Scams and ripoffs come in all shapes and sizes. There are the big rackets, like the Ponzi scheme we just heard about. There's the nickel and diming you get at the hands of banks, right? And then there's everything in between. Hillary and Jim Callahan live in Birmingham, Michigan. They were scammed out of cash by an automated ordering scheme through their L.L. Bean credit card. They wrote to us about it at marketplacemoney.org. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right. So tell us what happened with the Tale of Two Watches.
Well, it's more than two, but I'll let Jim.
I had ordered something from L.L. Bean, and in the process, I used my L.L. Bean credit card. And then I was asked, as a pop-up, would I be willing to evaluate my transaction with L.L. Bean? And I said yes. And then I was asked a series of questions. And at the end, it basically said, because of your willing to do this, We will send you a watch for as long as you pay the shipping charges, which I believe were $5.99. So I said, okay, fine. Anyhow, so the watch came, and it was no big deal. It's just an ordinary watch. And then another watch showed up, and I said to Hillary, there must be a mistake that they've made here. Because, you know, we didn't order any watch, and the second one is here.
And there was no label on the outside.
And we were trying to find out, you know, who had sent it and how to send it back. But
we still thought we were dealing with L.L. Bean.
Yeah. So then I got another watch shortly thereafter. And
this is number three now.
This is number three. That's when I became very suspicious about what was going on. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, since I only used my L.L. Bean credit card to order things from L.L. Bean, I wasn't even bothering to look. Unbeknownst to me, however, they were being charged, or we were being charged, roughly $50 each for these unsolicited watches. And I was perturbed. So I finally called L.L. Bean, and they referred me to the credit card, which was Citibank, who was controlling that issue. And when I called Citibank, and they said, well, we can get you a name for you to call or a number. So I got the number. A young lady answered the phone. I explained the situation. I said, I never ordered these watches. I never authorized these watches to be sent. And she said, well, I'll get you a return. You can't send the watches back to us without a code number or a return number. And I said, I would like to have that. And she said, I will get that to you shortly. About a week went by. I heard nothing. Now take a look at my L.L. Bean credit card. And there is now late charges attached. So I kind of blew up at that particular point. And I called and I said, look, this is ridiculous. You must have given these people my credit card number. I don't know how else they would have gotten it. And they said, no, we didn't do that. But we'll get. I can get you some information as far as the name of the company and where it is. So then I began to have this email back and forth with the people at the MNC Watches. And he said, I didn't read the fine print because the fine print, when I spent the $5.95, it said that I would was authorizing them to send me something once a month.
You had to call them and tell them that you no longer wanted to be an auto dealer.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing like when a charge for a ringtone, for example, ends up on your cell phone bill. And you wonder, well, how did AT&T or Verizon allow that to happen?
Yeah.
Well, they've got a relationship with that other company.
Oh.
And that's probably what happened here. All right, so where are we at now? First of all, how deep in the hole are you? How much money has been involved here?
I think the credit card was hit for like $149 over the couple of months. And frankly, I've got two watches and boxes I can sell you if you're interested.
No, I think I'm good on the whole watch thing at this point. Here's the big takeaway here, and that is when you see online surveys, that's always a red flag.
I didn't know that, and we do now.
Yeah, we do now.
Now you do. I mean, be very careful. And when it comes to fine print, I don't know if they gave you the fine print or not. And sometimes some more scammy operations will claim they had fine print, and there was no disclosure whatsoever. So in this case, they had to get your credit card information from somewhere, and I'm guessing it was Citibank. But all financial institutions need to do a better job of housekeeping to make sure that parasites like this don't get anywhere close to their customers.
Amen.
And at this point, I'd say with those cheapo watches eBay is your friend.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. I appreciate
Jim,
it.
Jim, Hillary, thank you very much for joining us.
You betcha.
Thank you.
High-interest payday loans are seen by critics as a fast track to endless cycles of debt for borrowers. Are they a scam? Some would say yes, although they're legal. Certainly, no one would challenge that they're dangerous. That's why many states have adopted regulations intended to limit the damage that payday loans can inflict on people's finances. But a new breed of payday loan has emerged that does an end run around state regulations, or at least so the lenders hope. These are loans made online by Indian tribes, which claim sovereign immunity from state and local rules.
So-called tribal lenders say they have to adhere only to federal regulations, which tend to be far less strict than what states have imposed. To tell us more, we're joined by Tom Feltner. He's Director of Financial Services at the Consumer Federation of America. Hiya, Tom.
Thank you for having me, David.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about payday loans in general, whether we call them that, whether we call them emergency cash loans. What are they?
Payday loans are very high-cost loans, sometimes exceeding triple-digit interest rates, 300-400%. The payments are tied to the date of your next payday, and they usually rely on abusive collection tactics such as holding a post-dated check or holding direct access to your bank account through electronic transfer.
And I would guess that one of the dangers here is that if you didn't have the money up front, chances are you're not going to have the money at the back end to pay the thing off, and you get into this endless cycle of debt.
The vast majority of these loans are balloon payment loans, meaning that the entire amount is due on the borrower's next payday. And if the borrower can't make that entire amount, then they have an additional interest fee. And so what we see is these loans rolled over and over and over again.
All right. And a lot of states, including California, have stepped up to bring out regulations to try and limit the damage that these things can do to consumers. But there's a variation on the theme out there, and that is payday loans offered online by Native American tribes. For example, you might have heard this.
The problem solver from Western Sky. Get up to $10,000 without collateral. Enough to pay off your payday advances once and for all. And making the fixed monthly payments is good for your credit profile. So call 888-SKY-1224. Problem solved.
What makes that different from a traditional payday loan?
Well, David, there's almost no difference between loans offered by lenders claiming tribal sovereign immunity and operating online and those types of shorter-term loans that you would get through a traditional storefront lender. They're still very high cost. They still have payments tied to your next payday, and they still rely on direct access to your bank account to enforce collection.
You just used the phrase claiming tribal sovereign immunity. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think one of the ongoing consumer protection issues with these types of loans, lenders claiming tribal sovereign immunity, is many of these lenders aren't actually arms of the tribe, meaning that they're not operated directly by a Native American tribe. Instead, they're offered by members of the tribe or other lenders that are partnering with tribes in order to claim that tribal sovereign immunity to evade prohibitions or strong consumer protections in states that currently limit payday loans, such as the cost or the terms and conditions.
Okay, let me make sure I understand this correctly. Whereas a number of states have imposed regulations to limit how much interest can be charged, for example, or to increase transparency for payday loans, you're saying that these loans that are offered by the Indian tribes or by organizations affiliated with the Indian tribes, they aren't subject to state law?
State law requires that lenders that make loans to borrowers in states that permit payday lending carry a license. Now, by partnering with Native American tribes or claiming that tribal sovereign immunity, these lenders are saying that they're not subject to state law and that they can make loans online to any state in the country.
So what law are they subject to?
Well, many of these lenders claim that they are subject to tribal law. In many cases, tribal law puts very few restrictions on these types of loans. So there could be no rate caps or there could be no limits on the number of loans per year. In other cases, we see tribal lenders simply not making loans in the state where that tribe is located, instead trying to export limited consumer protections throughout the entire country.
Another element of these tribal loans is because they're billing them as emergency cash infusions, they ask for your bank account number so that they can give you the money very quickly, put it into your account. But then they have your bank account number, and they make their withdrawals of interest payments therefrom. And I've heard from some people who say that can start racking up the overdraft charges very quickly.
Well, once a lender has direct access to your bank account, they really have an unfettered ability to collect that loan, whether the payments or the entire amount. That's one of the challenges that we've seen in some lenders claiming tribal sovereign immunity, is that while disclosing maybe only one fee for the first payment, these lenders continue to withdraw payments, you know, paycheck after paycheck, accruing a fee each time.
Well, why can't you just tell your bank to no longer allow this particular party to withdraw money from your account?
That's been an ongoing challenge, and consumer advocates have engaged banks on a number of different levels in order to ask them to revise their policies to make it easier for consumers to do so. And recently, JPMorgan Chase announced that they would make it easier for consumers to limit who can make withdrawals, and that's primarily to address ongoing concerns about the collection of payday loans through electronic access to bank accounts.
All right, so what should I know as a consumer if I get a notice in the mail or in my inbox saying, hey, if you need cash, we're a tribe and we've got money to burn. Here you go.
Anytime a lender offers the opportunity for quick cash and requires that you give up personal financial information, such as a social security number or bank account number. That should raise a red flag for consumers.
One thing also keep in mind is the annual percentage rate for some of these loans can top 600%, and that's not disclosed in most of the mailings. Tom Feltner is Director of Financial Services at the Consumer Federation of America. Tom, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, David.
Like I said before, I see a lot of scams from my perch at the LA Times. There are the ringtone scams that slam your credit card with recurring fees. There are the bogus lottery scams, the fake check scams, and of course, everyone's favorite, the Nigerian 419 scam. And then there's Rachel.
Hello, this is Rachel at Cardholder Services, calling in reference to your current credit card account. There are no problems currently with your account. It is urgent that you contact us concerning your eligibility for lowering your interest rate. Your eligibility expires shortly, so please consider this your final notice. Please press number 1 on your phone now to speak with a live operator and lower your interest rate, or press number 2 to discontinue further notices. Thank you.
So who is this, Rachel? The answer to that, here's Katie Daffin. She's a staff attorney in the Federal Trade Commission's Division of Marketing Practices. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. The Rachel calls. I mean, I'm getting emails all the time from people who are complaining about this. What is the basic scam here?
So these are robocalls. In other words, you pick up the phone and you don't hear a human, you hear a pre-recorded message. And usually they're claiming that they can reduce your credit card interest rate substantially. And because of that, you'll be saving thousands of dollars. And advances in technology have also made it easy for them to what's called spoof the caller ID information that the consumer sees on their telephone. So it might say the name of your bank, or it might say Cardholder Services, and trick consumers into thinking that they're talking about their own accounts when really that is not the case.
So when you click one and a live human comes on the line, what happens then?
At that point, the live human will see if you are eligible for the scam. In other words, they're looking for people with a certain amount of credit card debt and that meet some other criteria. If you do meet those criteria, they will forward you to the next line in the chain, which is somebody who's going to try to make charges to your credit card and claiming that they are going to be able to reduce your interest rates. But what we've seen is that actually they do not do that and that consumers just end up losing that money outright.
Or you could be locked into a new credit card with a higher interest rate.
That's right. Or they could make recurring charges to your current credit card. We've seen a lot of different versions of this scam, unfortunately.
Well, Rachel's been around for quite some time now. How is it that the FTC hasn't been able to shut her and her minions down?
Well, there are a lot of minions. I mean, when you hear these calls, you think that they're coming from one particular entity or scam artist. But in fact, this is a readily available recording, and people have found that it's easily compressible. In other words, it's very easy to and cheap to send out this message to millions of people at the same time. And so a lot of different fraudsters all over the world are using the exact same message and the same pitch. Now, the FTC has been able to stop a lot of them. For example, just in November, we shut down 5 of the companies that were using these cardholder services messages. But there are others that are still out there trying to do the same scam.
Sounds like whack-a-mole.
Exactly. It is very difficult, especially with today's technology, where you don't need a special boiler room or special equipment. Really, all you need is an internet connection, and you can blast out millions of calls. And it's very cheap to do that. And it's also a lot easier to hide your identity when you're doing so.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the Rachel calls are an example of robocalls. I've been getting a lot of complaints about this on my line over at the LA Times. What is the FTC doing about this trend?
Well, the vast majority of sales robocalls that people are receiving are completely illegal under the FTC telemarketing sales rule. Basically, if you haven't given your express written consent to receive that call from that entity, then it's an illegal call. But what we're finding is the changes in technology have made it so cheap and easy to do that the calls are proliferating anyway. So we're taking a multi-pronged approach to that problem, which involves aggressive law enforcement, a steady drumbeat of cases. We've brought over 100 cases to enforce the do not call list. And then we're also improving our targeting, making it more strategic. For example, we have a new robocall honeypot where we receive robocalls calls so we can act on them more quickly. And then we're also working with industry and other experts to try to identify technological solutions to this problem. I mean, we all have spam filters, but there's nothing similar for the telephone.
So let's say I'm already on the do not call list, but I'm getting calls from Rachel, I'm getting calls from other robocallers. What do I do?
Our advice is when you hear a pre-recorded message and it's a sales pitch, just hang up the phone. Do not press 1, do not press 2 to get yourself removed from the list. These calls are illegal in the first place, so it's unlikely that somebody will actually be creating a list and not calling you back the second time. In fact, we suspect that a lot of times they're just trying to identify which numbers are working telephone numbers, and you might be added to lists and get more robocalls. The one thing that consumers can do and that we really encourage is report these calls to the Federal Trade Commission at donotcall.gov. Those reports really are crucial to us in our targeting and our law enforcement efforts.
Katie Daffin is staff attorney with the Federal Trade Commission. Katie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks again.
Now that the days are getting longer and the sun's shining brighter, the money team is already thinking about summer vacation. Of course we are. And we're booking time off, searching for deals, and dreaming of a few days on the beach. We know you're thinking the same because many of you have written in asking for help with travel plans. So I'm here to say, keep those questions coming. We're going to focus on travel in next week's show. So if you're looking for help with your vacation decisions, let us know. And if you have a travel story that you think others can learn from, send it in. We're on Facebook, on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank, and at MarketplaceMoney.org. Craigslist can be a great place to find deals. It can also be a nest of vipers when it comes to con artists. Tony Tabora Roberts wrote to us on Facebook about a time she and her fiancé used Craigslist to hire movers and then got taken for a ride along with their furniture. Hiya, Tony.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So a few years back, you made a move from San Francisco, the Bay Area, to Davis, California. Did all go smoothly?
Not quite. We were moving, and my husband was starting to go to grad school, so we didn't have a lot of money at the time. So we tried to look for movers to help us move, make that move, and we found some movers on Craigslist, and we got scammed.
Did they seem to be a reputable company, or was it a couple of guys in a truck?
It was a couple of guys in a truck.
And when they pulled up in front of your home in the first place and you saw that it was a couple of guys in a truck, did you have any misgivings?
We did. One of the guys looked like, you know, what you would expect for a mover, but one of the guys didn't look like he was in great shape to be a heavy lifting mover. So we definitely, our hackles were a little up at that point, but we felt like there was no turning back.
What did the other guy look like?
He was kind of this scrawny older man, maybe even in his 70s. And, you know, we were moving large boxes and furniture up and down stairs. So we were a little concerned about that.
I'm sorry. So Grandpa Walton shows up and these guys are going to move you and you guys are going, oh, okay.
Yeah, we're moving. You know, we didn't have, you know, just a little bit of stuff. We, you know, that's why we hired movers. We had quite a lot of stuff. So that was maybe one of the first signs.
And they gave you an estimate up front, I assume?
Oh, yeah. No, I think we had I remember that we worked it out ahead of time because, you know, we had to know if it was within our budget. And, you know, movers ask you those typical questions of how many rooms do you have and how many boxes, that sort of thing. And so we'd worked out the price in advance.
And what was the price?
I think it was about $250.
Cheap.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that was within our budget.
Okay. So even though you're going to put the older fellow in the hospital with this move, you know, great. You're getting off okay. So these guys pack up the truck, cart it all off to Davis. And what happens?
No. Actually, they moved all the stuff out of our house in San Francisco. And then as, you know, they've got all the stuff in the truck outside of our house. And they say, well, you know what? That was a lot harder than we thought. So we need more money.
After it's in the truck.
After it's in the truck. And so, you know, we were like, well, you know, we agreed to this price. We can't pay you more money. So they said, well, if you don't pay us, we'll put all your stuff out here on the sidewalk.
How much more did they want?
We worked it out to be $150. And not only that, when once you know, we had to follow them to, you know, in our car to Davis, California, which is, you know, an hour and a half away, and we kind of had to help them move the rest of the stuff on the other end.
You had to unpack the truck?
Yeah. So we had to help. You know, we were doing that anyways, but, you know, we just had to do a lot more than we expected.
Did you know that the moving industry is regulated?
No, I didn't.
Do you know which agency in California regulates the moving industry?
Department of Transportation?
No, maybe? It's the Public Utilities Commission, of all things.
Oh, that's weird.
Who knew, right?
I would have never guessed that.
Exactly. It's not well publicized, I think, and I believe moving operations in virtually every state is regulated as well. And everybody listening should be aware of this, that this is a relatively common racket. And if your stuff gets held hostage, and I've heard stories about the movers actually taking people's stuff to a storage facility and not even giving it back until they get the money they want. You want to go to the authorities. I mean, I understand completely, Tony, that you didn't want to mess with these guys. Who would, right?
Right. And I don't even know if we felt like we could track them down. You know, I don't know. They just seem pretty shifty.
Yeah. You still use Craigslist?
You know, I do. I still use Craigslist for personal, like one-to-one, you know, selling of items. But no, I never go to the services anymore. I don't trust that.
Tony, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Many scams occupy a legal or ethical gray area. So what might look like a ripoff to one person could represent a nifty business opportunity to another. Marie McDonald lives in Winthrop, Massachusetts. Several years ago, she purchased her first home in southern Maine, a fixer-upper in a nice neighborhood. Now she realizes the broker, the seller, the closing attorney, even the home inspector were in cahoots during her deal. Marie came to us via the Public Insight Network. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be on here. I'm a big fan.
So you're in the Boston vicinity, is that right?
I am. I actually live in a little town called Winthrop, right outside Boston.
Did you know anyone who ran in the marathon?
You know, I did know a lot of people who, you know, were in the marathon or who worked at MIT or who were at the finish line.
Were any of your acquaintances injured?
No, thank goodness. Mercifully, yeah. But it touches everyone.
All right, Marie, let's shift gears here. We're talking scams, tragedy of a different nature.
Yes, much more minor nature.
Tell us your story.
Oh, okay. Well, my story started, it was quite some time ago. It was about a decade ago. I had been very, very, very eager to buy a home. And, you know, I didn't really have a lot of resources or a lot of help, but I had looked and looked and looked and looked, and I did what they tell you to do, which is I found the worst house in the best area.
And how do you define the worst house in that neighborhood?
Antique would be kind of a fancy word. Antique mobile home from probably the 50s on its own little piece of land in lovely, lovely southern Maine. So it's a beautiful area right outside Portsmouth, but the structure itself is a nightmare. Like you would see it on, you know, one of those reality shows where they're just going to tear it down like with their bare hands.
All right, so now you've got this haunted mobile home from a Stephen King story.
Yeah.
Southern Maine, but still, what happens?
I ended up trusting the realtor that I had found the home through when he said, hey, no problem. You know, the seller can finance it for you. I said, well, that's great. That's wonderful. Sign me up. Not really realizing that perhaps there were some ethics issues that might not be observed there in terms of disclosure. He basically asked me, you know, very leading questions about my finances and then promptly turned around and reported those answers to the seller.
So just to be clear, the realtor is representing both you and the seller.
Yeah, dual agency, I think, is what it's called.
So that's a very, very mixed interest here.
It is supposed to be acceptable, but there are supposed to be, you know, certain restrictions that are observed, and I don't see that they were. One question that was asked me was, what's the highest interest rate you might find if you're looking for a mortgage, before I had agreed with seller financing? And I said, I don't know, and I just pulled a number out of the air. So I said, oh, you know, well, hopefully I can get something for less than 13%. So that's the rate that I got from the seller.
That's a funny coincidence, huh?
I know. And I had an attorney for the closing who looked over all the documents and didn't really seem to do anything other than sort of sign off on everything. So I don't know, you know, what the convergence was that, you know, the various professionals that I had involved and that I had trusted didn't really come through. But
wait a minute. Did you have an inspector come out and look at the place?
I did have an inspector come out. And it turned out my realtor said, hey, I know an inspector you can use. And I said, great, I'll call him tomorrow. So I had the inspector that the realtor recommended come out. And they were apparently good buddies. They were chatting. It's a small town. And he inspected the place and said, yeah, no problems. It's all fine. But in reality, it was really, really, really as far as you can get from fine. The piping for the kitchen sink for the drain wasn't there.
Like, the inspector missed that part?
Yeah, you know, he's just going to sign off on it anyway.
All right, there's some moving parts here, obviously. And the first thing which you have highlighted very clearly is don't let emotions get in the way of money.
Now, isn't a home purchase always, you know, your first home always going to be an emotional investment, though?
As is your first car. So, yes. And it's always good to have a friend or a family member or
inspector, maybe.
Yeah, or the guy who missed the kitchen sink to at least gut check you and be able to ask the right questions. Unfortunately, you didn't have that team on your side. And that's where the quote-unquote scam kind of got into place here, is because you're dealing with some guy and his cousin, you know. And I think one takeaway from your experience is once you start seeing those red flags pile up, and I don't care how nice a piece of property it is, you walk away at that
point. Yeah, you don't keep walking through the blizzard.
Yeah, exactly. You don't figure that the weather's going to clear up.
Very true.
So you got to go in with your eyes open. Now, as for what you do here, this is obviously going to be your call. You might want to hold on to it as an investment asset, as long as it's not burning a hole in your pocket. And is it? Are you paying a lot in property taxes?
No, it's very reasonable. And I mean, it's been vacant for several years. So I've been paying mortgage and rent on the places that I'm actually living in because I don't live there anymore.
Marie, if it was me, I'd hang on to it because, hey, Southern Maine, you know, what's not to like?
This is true. I mean, it's a nice big piggy bank.
Marie, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much for your help. I appreciate it.
And that's all the time we have for scams on the show this week. But we're continuing the conversation online. Go to MarketplaceMoney.org for a list of 10 simple things you can do to make sure you don't get taken to the cleaners. Before we go, one more important piece of business to attend to. Remember our taxes and poetry competition? Ah, we got a winner. Ding, ding, ding. The first ever Marketplace Money Poet Laureate is Marcia Hood. And here she is.
Ode, O-W-E-D, to the IRS. It's April. I can't take the tension, crunching numbers to file an extension. I can't make a dent like the top 1%. It's taxing to not have a pension.
That was just beautiful. And to show our high esteem for your poetic triumph, Marcia, I'm proud to say we'll be sending you a coveted Marketplace Money Pig. Woohoo! Plus, yes, a signed copy of senior producer Patty Hirsch's book, Man vs. Markets, Economics Explained, Plain and Simple. Heck, if we're giving out copies of Patty's book, I've got my own poetic jewel to offer. It's a haiku. Wait for it. The rich got richer, or so a new report shows, not so much for us. That's a haiku. Thank you very much. And that'll do it for Marketplace Money for this week. Let us know what you think of the show at MarketplaceMoney.org. You can check out all of our poems there, of course. You can get in touch with us on our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next week, we're talking travel.
I don't want to be in the car anymore. I want to go home.
Yeah, it's been a real drag, Dad. Wally World's overrated anyway.
This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun. I gotta be crazy. I'm on a pilgrimage to see a moose.
Once again, we'd like to hear from you on the show. So write to us with any questions you might have about money, travel. Tell us your travel stories, too. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Iambic Pentameter Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Perinata. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace Money general manager is J.J. Yore. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. Have a great weekend.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.